Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, thanks to Vanessa from Banksia and welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number, I think 1583, entitled Bring Him Home.
Aww.
Our podcast title is Crocodile Eddie.
Very good.
I'm Rob Jan.
And Megan McHugh.
And we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future. And not only would we like to do that, we have just done that. Okay. Today, congratulations in order to the Artemis II mission crew.
Yes, they've splashed down.
They have, and NASA. It was such a joy to watch that. I was glued to the television screen.
Yeah. We need a bit of feel-good stuff at the moment in the news.
So
and I do think so much about it, like including the crew and just some of the words they shared and the little Project Hail Mary references and things. Like, it was what we needed, I think we can all agree.
Successful completion of the first crewed lunar mission since 1972. That's crewed, not crude.
Far from it.
9-day flyby tested capabilities for eventual crewed lunar landings and also notched up some notable socio-cultural goals related to flying to the moon. To wit, the first person of colour, pilot Victor Glover, the first woman the first woman to fly to the moon, Christina Koch. Mm-hmm. She's an International Space Station veteran who's already conducted the first all-female spacewalks there. And she holds the record for the longest continuous space flight by a woman, which is 328 days. It's also the first non-US mission specialist, Jeremy Hansen from Canada. Mm-hmm. This flight was actually his first space flight as well.
Gosh, that's a story for the Christmas table to this year.
And, of course, mission commander Reid Wiseman at age 50, the oldest person to travel beyond low Earth orbit. And during the flyby, the crew also set the record for furthest distance travelled by humans from Earth, which is 406,000 kilometres.
Crikey.
As many people have noted, the people who have been furthest from Donald Trump. Except that he called them up. He can't get away. They also kicked a lot of science goals, transmitted data at a rate of 260 Mbps to Earth via a laser-based optical communication system. Space lasers!
Very
yes.
cool.
They used biochips called avatars, which is a great long acronym, which mimicked human organs to test biological responses to conditions beyond Earth's orbit. They were chipped, basically. They carried and launched a small flock of cube satellites, which are exactly what it says, to gather data that will be useful for further Artemis lunar flights. Not all of them worked, but, you know, this is the way it goes. And they carried out detailed photographic and visual examinations of the far side of the moon. They looked at it. Note that I said far side and not dark side. There is a dark side to the moon, but it's a movable feast. We actually only see one side of the moon because it's what they call totally locked to the Earth. Like, it's the same rotation speed.
Yes.
So we only see that. But the terminator of light and dark does actually move around. Mm. Okay, so there were some problems aboard. They had issues with the toilet, of all things, which is kind of a first, because the Apollo missions didn't have a toilet on board. They had bags, basically.
Well, does the job.
Well, quite literally. And they had to leave some of that behind on the moon last time. But this time, well, they had some issues.
Okay.
Fortunately, they had an engineer, Christina. She fixed it, more or less. And they also had some problems with some of the propellant in the thrusters. So that could be something they'll need to fix up. And look, I've been following this mission for a while, and I was very white knuckled when they were coming in because they were doing something unusual because of the heat shield.
Yeah,
I won't go into that. Everyone's already done that, but still. And I have to comment upon the enormous positive global interest in this project.
Yes,
it's almost as if inclusively diverse, crewed, science celebrating, outward looking, internationally cooperative space missions. They're more inspirational to humanity than bigotry, science denying, grifting, sycophancy, and gaslighting bullying. And who could have predicted that?
Yeah.
No one would have thought that. And by international cooperation, I don't just mean the inclusion of a Canadian astronaut amongst the crew, although that's pretty cool. But, for example, the fact that the entire back end of the spacecraft, the service module behind the Orion capsule, that was built in Europe.
Mm.
That's the bit with the solar panels that you can see
in
the back, which is now all burnt up.
Yep, as expected.
Yeah, as expected. It was the European service module built by the European Space Agency based on ESA's automated transfer vehicle, which is, yes, called an ATV. And that was designed to make unmanned cargo flights to the International Space Station.
Yep.
And to be kind of an ESA space workhorse.
Mm.
And currently it's planned that ESAs will be incorporated upon at least all the missions until Artemis 6.
Okay.
And the Artemis 3 mission, so far scheduled for 2027, involves a low Earth orbit rendezvous with one or both commercially built lunar landers, which have been contracted out to SpaceX.
Mm.
And or Blue Origin.
Okay. Yeah,
either or both of those competing commercial lander projects may or may not be ready in time. So there's that caveat. You know, rocket science is rocket science. It takes as long as it takes. And it took so long to get the astronauts out of the capsule after they'd splashed down on in the Pacific because they'd been in zero-G for more or less 9 days.
Yep.
And as we all know, zero-G always leaves you a bit wobbly.
It leaves its impact, doesn't it?
Yes. Pardon the time it took for them to struggle into their Fantastic Four costumes, you know. So, and I think that Reed Wiseman, of course, is Marvel code for Reed Richards. You know, so anyway, for now, bloody well done. Yeah, science.
Yeah, science.
Yeah.
I did just want to call out my favourite part was that they have the little Artemis the cat plush from Sailor Moon in the Launch Command Center.
I thought of you when they said, Megan's got to know this.
I was like, that's a really great little nod. I thought that was a nice detail.
Yeah. I think that their pop culture was strong.
Yes. Oh, it always is, I think.
But now it's like, you know, because they had their own phones as well. They had iPhones with them.
Yes. Took that notable photograph of the Earth as well with the iPhone.
With Christina's braids.
Yeah.
First braids in off to the moon. So do we have a track? Yes, we do. We have Artemis 2, Beyond the First Horizon. And there's so many people who've put together albums or tracks of about course. This mission. From Jane's Signal, and this is a single signal from Signal, and so it is just Artemis 2, Beyond the First Horizon. I liked it. It's got a sort of a noble soundtrack feel to it.
Hello, me little lovelies. This is your old fat Artie Jack on Radio Free Triple R. You're listening to Zero G, and if you don't listen to it closely, I'm going to jump through your speakers and rip your bloody arms off, and I will too.
Yes, I hope you're ready for a bloody good mystery because we're going to take a look at Deadlock Season 2. That, of course, was the Deadlock theme composed by Amanda Brown, who's an Australian musician and composer. She was in the Go-Betweens back in the 80s and has been composing music for the screen since about the turn of the millennia. That track was Deadlock Theme.
And before that, we had a track commemorating the Artemis 2 mission called Artemis 2 Beyond the Horizon by Jane's Signal.
So before we jump into sort of Deadlock Season 2, just want to cast our minds back to Season 1. So this series, Deadlock, was created by Kate McCartney and Kate McLennan, also known as The Kates, and it's on Amazon Prime. It is an Amazon Prime production. So Season 2 has dropped and we do have a new location and a new crime, but If we think back to season one, that was set in the fictional Tassie town of Dedlock, hence the title, and it introduced us to the serious, dedicated Detective Dulcie Collins and also the unconventional Detective Eddie Redcliffe as the unlikely pair investigated a series of homicides in the otherwise fairly sleepy, misty, moody town of Dedlock. So Dulcie's careful investigation often clashed with Eddie's more sort of shoot from the hip style. But of course, by the end of season one, they had won us over and it was quite clear that they do make a formidable, if odd, duo. So we kind of grab on to a little story thread from the end of season one as we head into season two. But this season, instead of the misty moors, I don't think we call them moors, but you know what I mean, of Tasmania, we are now in the humid, sticky top end for a croc-infested mystery inside the town of Barra Creek, where once again Dulcie and Eddie get thrown into the midst of a murder investigation. It's a little bit Angela Lansbury, Jessica Fletcher. It's like everywhere they go, I mean, they're police. I suppose it's their job to investigate murders, but the murders just kind of happen to them, you know, without any sort of plan or clear reason. But they must then grapple with the mysteries of the town and more than a few colourful characters inside Barra Creek. From the start of episode one, we're thrown right into the action when a croc tour boat, namely Don Darrell's best jumping croc tours, to be exact, full of poor unsuspecting tourists, stumbles on a dead, unidentified croc in the river with a little surprise lodged in its mouth.
Yes, Captain Hook's
hand. Yeah. Yes.
Tick-tock, tick-tock.
But this actually isn't the first mystery that the town is grappling with. This is off the back of a recent disappearance of a couple of backpackers from the area, which is already being investigated by a pack of very performative male detectives who, needless to say, don't inspire much confidence.
Oh, 100%.
And truly obviously have nothing on our formidable duo. But along the way, we sort of get to know the local police, the rangers of the area. There's a local journo who gets embroiled in things. And some of the classic settings include the local pub, the river, which is, of course, croc-infested. We are on the top end. And we learn more and more about a town rivalry between the various croc tours and croc attractions of the area.
As well as containing environmental themes and also colonisation themes involving First Nations people.
Yes, I was glad to see that they've incorporated Indigenous actors in the story and incorporated a lot of information about, what's happening to country out in that area as well. So honestly, by the end of episode one, an intriguing mystery has been laid out for us and you get pretty hooked pretty fast, like a croc leaping for some chicken necks. And I think episode to episode, it just keeps getting kind of better and better with the little cliffhangers and the little twists and turns, some red herrings, some revelations, and we get to know more and more of the characters and unlock a little bit extra of their character development too.
Absolutely.
It's quite clever and very, very well paced. You've seen the whole lot.
Six episodes?
Yes. So six episodes, they're all out available now on Amazon Prime. I'm halfway through and I'm definitely in the midst of a pretty big cliffhanger now. And I think the beauty of the series is, like I said, episode one, you're hooked. Episode two, you get more information. It includes a few more of the characters of the town. We get to see maybe some of the long-standing drama or long-standing relationships between different townspeople, how they've unfolded. And then by episode three, there's bits of information dropped left and right. There's, red herrings kind of appearing and then being dismissed, and then we start to uncover probably what is a much larger plot afoot.
A foot.
And I won't say actually what else we find in episode three.
Other bodily components.
Look, it's a bit early on a Monday for that.
Yeah, enjoy your lunch. Okay, so some characters?
Yes. So we once again have the combo of Dulcie Collins and Eddie Redcliffe from season one, played again beautifully by, we've got Kate Box as Dulcie Collins and we've got Madeline Sammy as Eddie Redcliffe, and they're wonderful. Kate Box plays Dulcie. I really think her performance is such a great anchor for the show. She's so serious and it's always this slight fish out of water because she's a very serious, very dedicated detective who obviously wants to play by the book and make sure she's doing a really good job as she's investigating, doing everything right. Which is, needless to say, other law enforcement in the area. It's a little bit more scrappy.
Well, she came. Her character comes from the city, so she's from Sydney. So in the first story, she's down in Tasmania in a small town. So, as you said, fish out of water. Now, instead of going back to the city, she's gone to a small town in the Northern Territory.
Yeah.
So once again, way out of it.
Yeah.
And she's got problems with her devotion to her job, which is not matched by the job's devotion to her.
Mm.
And this becomes increasingly plain. Apart, you know, that that task force of incompetent detectives.
I know that the incompetence is used sort of for laughs in this series, but sometimes I truly am just, I feel for Dulcie so much because she's really just out there doing her best.
And her best is actually very good.
She's a wonderful detective. And just some of the problems and friction she comes up against that is purely other people's incompetence is...
Well, Eddie, her partner, is not incompetent, but she is one of the problems that Dulcie has to deal
with. We'll say unconventional, to say the least.
Now, that's an interesting dichotomy there.
Yeah.
Now, she is a croc in her home waters this time.
Yes, yes.
And so what we get to see is what made her that way.
And actually, it's really great to start peeling back the layers of that character in season two, I think, because I think you can get, we've sort of got a decent grip on who Dulcie Collins is. Mm-hmm. And now we sort of do get to learn more about Eddie, her backstory, her early life, family, that kind of thing. But again, it's done in a really subtle way because it's woven into the central mystery.
Look, they are the heart and soul and other bodily parts of this story and of the series. And I actually find them two of the best buddy-buddy sort of cops that I have ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen quite a few detective shows set in all sorts of periods and from space to underwater and, you know, but these two are just perfect.
And it's not a new dynamic either. Obviously, you know, that's the classic odd couple, right? Someone's neat, someone's messy, both personality and strictly speaking. But it's executed in such a great way and there is so many unique little traits and the way they flesh out those characters is truly something I think is very much down to the writing and then also the acting of these really wonderful characters. So I totally agree. I also think then once you throw in the presence of Alicia Gardner as Kath York, who is Dulcie's partner, Kath is just a breath of fresh air. She's so wonderful. She's had, you know, she's worked as all, you know, she was a social worker, she was a vet. She's just a very caring, very warm presence. And, you know, she's a little bit...
alternative?
Yeah, and a little bit flaky in her way, but she's just such a warm energy on screen.
Well, you know, as the two detectives are great detectives, she is a great relationship person.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you noticed it, but she went with Dulcie to the Tasmanian town and set up their instantly informed relationships with the townsfolks.
Yeah.
She does the same in this.
Yeah.
And I think that she is this, like, a third background...
Yeah.
Sort of a glue that holds the whole thing together. And it could have been a show this time around where Kate Box's character, Dulcie, sort of steps into the background a bit because, you know, it is in Eddie's home area.
Yeah.
But that relationship pulls her back into it at all times. So it's this wonderful a troika that advances through the story.
I think that's such a good point. And I think that Kath's ability, she's like a chameleon, total opposite of Dulcie. Like she's ready and willing to make the most of her situation and she will really assimilate into the community and it'll become sort of a mutual appreciation.
And a key part of solving the mystery as usual.
Yes, I think Kath is a really great key character. And, yeah, like I said, I really like Kath. Why don't we hear a little bit more from the score?
Yes, yes.
So we're talking, of course, about Deadlock. Season 2 is out now, set up in the Top End. Score for Season 2 done again by the musician Amanda Brown. So Crocs are obviously a big part of this season and Croc Justice. And I thought we should hear a little bit of music. This one is called Best, Best Jumping Croc Tour.
Hi, this is Bear McCreary, and you're listening to Zero G.
You are listening to Zero G with Rob and Megan, and we are talking about Deadlock Season 2 and Croc Justice and so on and so forth.
Do you know they filmed, obviously, the town is actually a real place in the Northern Territory. It's not actually all that far from the uranium sort of mine sort of areas there. Just down the road, and I mean that in the Australian sense,
yeah.
Just down the road. But they actually couldn't film anything by the water in the Northern Territory. They had to film it in Queensland instead because safety.
Yes. I actually think what I really enjoyed about the series was the setting. I think obviously it's a masterstroke to move it from the Tassie location and go somewhere totally different, somewhere totally new, and not least so we can explore a little bit of the Eddie backstory, as I mentioned. But I really enjoyed seeing just the different things about that kind of environment and community and the role of the crocs in the community as well.
The like, role of the crocodile
because
role.
Because they're both, you know, they're kind of a danger and pest and they're kind of always sort of in the background, but they're a large part of the tourism of the area and how the community can make money. But then again, you know, no one can swim in any of the waters because it's dangerous. And it was interesting to see. I mean, I don't know how authentic.
Look, I've never been north of Perth or Brisbane. So to me, it is actually a foreign country in lots of ways. I do know a person up there who runs tours, nature tours, out there amongst the beasties and stuff. And I said to her, and shout out to Betty, I said to her, is it true to life? And she just said, yeah, absolutely. And I thought, can I trust you on this? Yeah, I'll go for that.
And I think the setting and kind of how immersed you feel straight away. Like I think part of it is right away I'm engaged in the mystery. I think it's a really great mystery from what I can see. Like I said, there's not wasting any time. It's a really fast-moving plot. And not only that, obviously you really, when you have a setting like that, what I want to be seeing is some great local characters, really fleshing out what it's like in that community and really sort of finding people to latch onto, some lovable eccentrics possibly. And I think the show does that really well.
Look, and if you happen to be a Territorian and you feel raw about some of the portrayals of the characters,
yeah.
Don't see me. It's not my show.
I would say I think it does lean in quite a lot to amping up some of the characters to be the stereotype or the caricature for laughs. But I don't know, there's a part of me that just felt it was always coming from a good place.
Yeah.
It doesn't really ever feel like punching down. It does feel like a bit of a piss take or a send up, but I do think the show has a lot of heart.
Yeah.
It's actually out to represent this story in a really genuine way, even though, there are definitely some characters that are there for purely to be laughed at.
And speaking of which, Nina Oyama playing Abby.
Yes, our returning character.
She's got a new career path. She was a cop down in the Tassie Deadlock. She's now got a career path with forensics.
Yeah.
And she finds her voice in this season.
Yeah.
Which is adorable, basically.
And that's, I mean, like I said, I'm about midway through, and as it should, it's starting to amp up a bit. We're really getting our little crew of our group together of people investigating different leads, including Abby, and there's also a local journo, Leo, and they're played by Jean Tong, who...
Oh, awesome character.
Yeah, really great character there from the start and just kind of hovering in the background, which is part of the joke of the character as well. Just
has
appearing.
Ninja-like ability to just sort of be there.
Which is a great skill for a journo, absolutely. But they've become embroiled in helping lend some tech skills and research skills. And I really love when a series hits its stride and you can see all of the pieces coming together and all of the characters
meshing. Do you feel
meshing.
Like with this one, we've almost got a Scooby gang?
Yeah.
That feels very...
Everyone's got going. A different... Because obviously Abby's coming in now with some forensic skills.
Yeah.
And then we have the research and the tech side. And then obviously we've got Eddie and Dulcie out pounding the pavement. And
if there was pavement.
Yes, exactly. I think... Also, the thing to mention is it's really funny. I laughed a lot.
Hilarious.
There is some genuine, I mean, a lot of it is crude humor, not going to lie, but I like crude humor, so I had a great time. But
speaking of crude, Luke Hemsworth.
Oh, yes. The third Hemsworth appears. I actually think there's four of them. But, yes, he does appear in a role. What's his character's
Jason
name again?
Jason Wade. He's a crocodile Dundee type or a Steve Irwin type, but with a poke in the eye to his brother Chris.
he's a very overdone, kind of slick, oiled up version, a showman.
Yeah, an influencer.
And it was quite fun seeing the difference between a more family-run, homegrown croc tour and then obviously Jason Wade, who's built this kind of croc tourism empire. And then just little details like, and this isn't really real, but like, you know, the staff at his place, they've all got like British or Irish accents, that kind of, you know, just little details. And I think just kind of leaning into the different dichotomies that you see in the area of a very commercial, very shiny packaged tourist kind of offering.
Yeah.
And then you've got...
It's not something that you normally... You know, we've moved on from the sort of Crocodile Dundee sort of Bushman type thing to a kind of a fake.
Yes, very...
Sort of
like
artificial.
Like I wouldn't believe that this man could actually save me from anything or wrestle a crocodile or knows anything about nature whatsoever.
Well, so well played by Luke, though, I thought. You know, spot on.
Having a lot of fun here, absolutely.
Mm. Have we got another track?
We do. Let's listen to another one. Great segue. We're going to listen to Dirk's River Reserve, again by Amanda Brown, who's done the score for Deadlock.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Morgan.
And I'm Reg Morgan.
No, we're actually Colin and Cameron Cairns.
Writers, directors of 100 Bloody Acres, and you're listening to Zero G.
They're not psycho killers. They're just community radio broadcasters. Is that all right?
Speaking of killers, we are talking Deadlock Season 2. That was Dirk's River Reserve by Amanda Brown. Look, overall, I love this show. I think Deadlock is so much fun. I feel very, very fondly towards it. I think, you know, it takes the piss a lot, but like I said, there's a really genuine heart at the center of it and core and a ripping mystery, which I think is really important if you're positing a show as a, you know, dark comedy mystery show. Often, sometimes shows will focus too much on the comedy or too much on the setting and not so much on the actual mystery story. And I think that this is a really well-scripted and well-paced mystery. That being said, I haven't gotten to the conclusion yet, but would you agree?
Yes, it's a good mystery. The first one, Deadlock Season 1, totally flummoxed me with the mystery. Mm. This one, I was able to work out a few more things because I'm more familiar with the show now.
Yeah.
But still a good mystery and resolved in a sort of... a mind-boggling way, as colourful as the language is.
I think, the main thing is the characters are so much fun to watch. I think it's really clever. And also I can really feel, like, the heat and humidity.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Just the details, like, they always look sweaty. You can tell, like, and you can almost feel, like, the dust and the sheen of sweat and the heat. And I think
that's because they shot in Queensland.
Yes, so it's probably just NT, legit. Yeah. But I love that. You know, again, it's another part of what makes you feel so immersed in it so early. I do want to say there was a funny quote that I laughed so hard. And I hate ruining quotes, but it was just a funny line where Dulcie, she's running along and she's like, I'm overheating. I'm like a computer on a lap. And I just thought that was great because computers on a lap do get very hot.
Eddie has an entirely...
We cannot say any of her lines on air, Rob. Absolutely not.
She has her entirely own, just rolling off the tongue sort of description of that same thing. In fact, the humidity is described constantly. There are many colourfully creative descriptions about it.
Yes. Almost sometimes throw away, like during a scene, you're like, oh, did I just hear what I thought?
I have to go back and listen to that.
Yes, very colourful language. But
speaking of colourful, because they're like black and blue and all the other colours of mortification, the prosthetics in this are excellent.
Yes.
You know, first-rate prosthetics.
The limb, the...
The body parts.
Parts.
Startling.
Yeah.
But so well done. And of course, I feel like the crocodiles are characters in this too.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the we were saying the locations, but, you know, really it does give you a sense of how isolated some of these places are, even though they're only – and I started – this is one of those shows where you can actually get the sense of place, and I mean the layout of the town.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that it's in relatively close proximity to Darwin.
It is, yes.
And then suddenly you're out there in the bush.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
So I thought they did that so well. I actually can't fault this show, apart from maybe there's some slight – I felt there were some slight Asian stereotypes. The journalist has to be the computer expert.
Sure.
You know, Abby has to be the technician who's slightly geeky.
Yeah.
You know, but that's all right.
At least there's Asians out there.
Yeah, lots of them in this story. In fact, it's a completely diverse cast. And I thought, you know, and I can't say this from a point of inclusion, but I thought that the LGBTQI components of the story were so beautifully told and such an integral part of the plot.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously we're in a part of the country where, yeah, there's going to be an Indigenous population as well, and we do meet some of those characters become quite core to the story too. Mm-hmm. And some really great actors as well. I really enjoyed – there's the Ranger character I really like.
Yes.
And so I think – yeah, everything sort of comes together, and as each more and more I get into it, I'm learning more and more about the town.
And the local, there's a whole story arc about the local policewoman, the town policewoman who's retiring.
Yeah.
And her replacement.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Moonboot.
Moonboot, yeah. Oh, that's what that means in my notes. Why did I write Moonboot? Of course, of course. You know, there's some stuff in this that I thought was amazingly well done. Such intricate subplots.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And sometimes you're like, oh, is that going to become a thing? And some do and some don't.
Yes.
And some are really just there. Even I love just the sense of all the scenes at the local pub, and you can just really feel, oh, this is, you know, they would go and they'd always sit in that seat. Mm. And then, I don't know, just that procedural around a small town, I think, again, they've really hit the nail on the head.
Can you have an over-the-top, top-end depiction?
I
don't know
about that. I will say some of the – and I think we know which characters. It's the Darryls. There's a lot of yelling. Some of the scenes can be quite frustrating because – and I think that's part of it too. We're meant to feel as frustrated as Dulcie does in some of these interactions, and with sort of coming into this world where there's a lot of unspoken rules and kind of social conduct that she's not familiar with as someone from the city. And as a viewer, I sometimes was like, what is happening? But I think that's kind of intentional.
It's an amazing family, the Darryls.
Yeah, oh, the Darryl. I do think that main Darryl lady, she's great. I think that Bev Killitch is Colleen Darryl. Mm. She's hilarious.
And we could go on for hours about
this. Actually could. I think this is a very, very strong year for me, and that's as someone who hasn't even completed it just yet, but I will absolutely be watching the rest of it today. Deadlock Season 2, it is on Amazon Prime. And definitely, I would say, too, you don't have to have watched Season 1. I recommend you do.
Oh, look, it's possible. But because parts of it deal with events laid down in Season 1.
You'll get the most out of it if you've watched
just watch,
both.
But, you know, you just watch it.
Why not? Yeah. Like, you'd be doing yourself a disservice because it's a really great show.
Mm. Interesting question, though, to try and postulate that.
Yeah. yes, Deadlock. Definite year for me, Rob. And I think...
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it for all my tracks. Mm. Shall we go into one that you've selected?
Yes, this is... from Daredevil, Born Again, Season 2. And this track is The Devil You Know by the Newton Brothers.
Hi, I'm Andrea Thompson, and I play Talia Winters, resident commercial telepath on Babylon 5. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR, and I know what you're thinking.
We just heard The Devil You Know from the Newton Brothers, which is from Daredevil Born Again, Season 2. And just wanted to say thank you so much to everyone who has subscribed as part of April Amnesty already this month. We are almost partway through April, and April Amnesty is going all month. So it is a chance for you to support Triple R in our 50th year, which is pretty epic. How many years have you done Zero G, Rob? Half of that?
Since before your sun burned hot in space. 1994 was when we started.
Wow, there you go. But yes, thank you very much. Your subscriptions, donations, everything, a really key part of keeping the station going. So if you feel like you can no longer survive the crushing guilt of not subscribing or donating, you can head along to rrr.org.au and check out all of the options for subscribing and such there. You'll, of course, go into the running for some great prizes, which you can see details about on the website too, but you'll also get all of the usual subscriber benefits, things like discounts at businesses, the bumper sticker, giveaways, gigs, all of that. So if you've maybe lapsed and you're ready to jump back in, now's the time, April Amnesty.
Mm. And speaking of crushing guilt, Daredevil and Matt Murdock's classic crushing Catholic guilt.
Gosh, which is what fuels him really in all things, isn't it?
1964, the character was invented by Stan Lee, Bill Everett and Jack Kirby. Mm-hmm. Superhero created for Marvel Comics. And, you know, that's the origin year for a lot of Marvel characters then. Matthew Michael Murdock, a lawyer from New York's Hell's Kitchen. As a child, he had the origin story of being hit in the head by a container of chemical ooze, basically. Oof. Which, yes, did also inspire the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Chemical ooze was really up to a lot in that era, wasn't it? It was working hard.
So he was blinded in that accident, and then because of reasons. And, you know, when you think with radiation and stuff and chemicals. So, of course, he became Daredevil with his radar sense.
Yes.
And the martial arts he had to work at a lot. His father was a boxer, and he's
dedicated.
Pooled up with a guy called Stick, who taught him more martial arts and so on. Anyway, so now he's a crime fighter. This was first adapted in the television film The Trial of the Incredible Hulk.
Oh.
Where Daredevil was portrayed by a teen idol called Rex Smith. Alongside Bill Bixby as Bruce Banner and Lou Ferrigno as the Hulk.
Wow.
And John Rhys-Davies playing Wilson Fisk.
What?
Yes, Salah from Indiana Jones and from the Slider series as well. He was playing Fisk.
I can see it, I guess. Can.
But, there's this whole alternative Daredevil thing. It was a backdoor pilot that failed.
Right.
And then, of course, there was the Daredevil live-action film in 2003 with Ben Affleck. And Jennifer Garner.
Yes, as Elektra. Her Elektra, yep.
Yeah. But more importantly, I think it had Jon Favreau playing Foggy Nelson, who later went on to film the first and second Iron Man films. The Seed, yeah. And so now, 2015, we had the Daredevil Netflix series, which went for 3 seasons. Absolutely brilliant.
Amazing.
Drew Goddard was the creator of that. Charlie Cox played Daredevil. Mm-hmm. Went on to play Daredevil in Spider-Man No Way Home, in the Defenders crossover series, She-Hulk Attorney at Law had a funny walk of shame, Echo, and also does the voice of Daredevil in your friendly neighbourhood animated Spider-Man series. And Fisk appears in other shows too. So this is the 13th television series in the MCU from Marvel Studios. I've seen 4 of the 8 episodes of season 2. It's really hit its stride. Mm. The first season was a bit choppy as they redirected it and changed creative directions. Yes. So they had to refilm some stuff and incorporate footage that they'd done, kind of like Echo in a way, but more extensive than that. The second season, I feel, is really cleaving into the feeling that we got from the Netflix series, but plus.
Okay.
So they really got it. Once again, we've got these amazing characters. Oh, by the way, Dario Scardapane is the showrunner and worked on the Punisher series as well.
Right.
Knows what they're doing and how. Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock / Daredevil. Once again, that dichotomy between the two characters. It's a little bit Batman in some ways.
It is.
He's struggling to protect his friends and colleagues. They're now formed a resistance group against Mayor Wilson Fisk. And look, yeah, this is torn from, I don't know what contemporary events it parallels in the United States. An evil, crooked mayor of a city with an agenda of his own.
Yeah.
Enriching himself at the expense of the population.
They do make that sort of parallel quite obvious, even from season one, that that's the direction they're going with that character.
And the problem that they have there, of course, as they do with the boys as well, is that they're being overtaken by real events all the time. Can they do worse than the current, you know, regime in the United States? Well, kind of. Vincent D'Onofrio is pretty damn good as Wilson Fisk, which means he's very bad.
Yes. He's great in that, as that character.
So the thing is, there's a dichotomy between Charlie Cox's Matt Murdock and Vincent's Wilson Fisk.
Yep.
Because they're two sides of the same
coin. Absolutely, yeah.
And Fisk has now got his Red Hook Freeport in operation in New York. They're shipping in weapons for reasons. And it's being interfered with by Daredevil. Fisk is having problems working with his wife, Vanessa, but also coming to appreciate how good, i.e. how bad, a villain she is in herself.
Yeah. She's no slouch when it comes to being the big bad, right?
And she does stuff in this season in particular, and you find out that she's been doing stuff and you think, oh, my God, are you the real brains behind this operation?
Match made in heaven.
Yeah. Or another place.
Yeah.
Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
And Fisk also has to deal with leaks in his office, and he's trying to fight the vigilantes as well. He's got that whole...
He's got a lot on his plate. Being a villain is
he's
very
tiring.
He's got a
lot on his plate.
He does, yeah.
You're right, it's tiring.
It is tiring.
I feel so sorry.
Just hang up your suit jacket.
Yeah, but the nuance and the sophistication of the relationship between these two characters.
Oh.
Hero who thinks he's a bit of a villain. Villain who thinks that he's a hero,
he's
but
saving,
he actually knows he's a villain.
Yeah.
So many things in there.
And their chemistry, of course, has been good from day one.
Hell's Kitchen, chef's kiss for the whole thing. Deborah Ann Wall is playing Karen Page again, who she's commenced this fall into something darker in her character. She's becoming a bit like the Punisher.
I don't know if I want to see that. I've always liked her as a breath of fresh air.
Yes, in this case... Don't hold your breath for that fresh air.
That's a bit of a bummer.
Yeah. And, of course, we've got this is such a large cast. I'm not going to go through them all. But one I do want to talk about is Matthew Lillard playing Mr. Charles.
Yes. Tarantino's favourite actor.
Yes. Also played Shaggy in the live-action Scooby-Doo movies and has voiced Shaggy ever since in the animated stuff. Also been in The Life of Chuck and Five Nights at Freddy's.
And Scream,
yes. He's playing a CIA agent who is working for Valentina Allegra Di Fontaine. So there's links to the Thunderbolts in this.
Got it.
And he's interesting because normally Fisk dominates and terrifies anyone around him, but Mr. Charles is not anyone's patsy, basically, even though he has problems. We've got Tony Dalton reprising his role as Jack Duquesne, the swordsman. I remember him as Lalo Salamanca from Breaking Bad, but he gets a lot of stuff in this too.
Nice.
We have a new White Tiger vigilante in a different form to the first season. And, oh, my God, the character of Bullseye, the FBI guy who went a bit cray-cray, ends up living up to his nom de plume of being a guy who can throw anything and hit the bullseye anytime. So he's now a supervillain, been broken out of jail. Stephen Bethel plays this character. He gets to do stuff in this season that just is off the scale. You know, and I was speaking about dichotomies before. He's a villain who thinks he's doing heroic stuff now.
Right.
And there is a scene in this season that just unbelievable. We haven't got to Jessica Jones, Kristen Ritter's character, coming up yet in the show, but you know, on the table, and possibly also some of the other defenders in this season, but we will see. We'll get back to that later on. And so, okay, halfway through, I am stunned by this season of Daredevil. The stunt choreography, which is a big part of any superhero show, is again moved on to the next corridor or the next diner. The dialogue between the characters is so arch and laden with subtext at every stage. Everybody is just so great in this show. And I can't wait to see the third season when it's greenlit, but I'm still watching the second season.
That's a good sign, I think. Thank goodness this was Born Again, because I think Daredevil was a real fan favourite. It was such a strong start to those Netflix Marvel TV series. Mm-hmm. And since then, like, the first one ended, people had been calling for, you know, more Daredevil, more Charlie Cox as Daredevil. And it is kind of cool that this managed to come into being.
And
be good.
As a relatively minor powered character in the Marvel Universe, he's street level. You know,
but that's what, like, I think we've always loved about that Daredevil, Jessica Jones. You know, it's a different side of things. Mm-hmm. It's much more scrappy and on the ground than kind of being up in the tower, the Avengers Tower, and so on.
Yeah.
And Charlie Cox is just, he is Matt Murdock to me.
Oh, of course, you know, they, as you know, Foggy Nelson was killed in the first season.
Yeah, like basically straight away.
Yeah, somebody one of the characters threw out an interesting thought about what if people can be replaced by shape-shifting Skrulls? That's actually a thing in the MCU.
I bet it is a big thing.
So I thought, I hadn't really thought of
that. Truly think anything is possible.
But I would have thought he would have reverted.
Yeah.
You know, but never mind. Okay, so that's about it for Zero G today.
Yeah.
We're coming up to Astral Glamour with Joe Brunetti. We've talked about Deadlock. We've talked about Daredevil Born Again Season 2. Deadlock, to me, is one of the great Australian television shows.
Yeah.
It is a hot show at the moment and humid.
Yes.
Oh, the humidity.
It feels fresh, unlike the limbs that have washed up from the river. But I really think it's something I would recommend, like, for anyone.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not children.
I've also been horrified by the latest season of The Boys, but then that's what it's for. And also,
it's keeping it at a 10, I think, intensity level, right?
And also very sad about the cancellation of Star Trek Starfleet Academy after season 2 for reasons. We won't go into that. But we've still got a season of that up our sleeves to watch. Okay, so we're going to have Rex Smith, the guy who was playing Daredevil in that Incredible Hulk episode, because he was a bit of a television star and a movie star and a teen idol, and this is a track called You Take My Breath Away from an album called Sooner or Later with Rex Smith. And you can imagine this alternative Daredevil coming up at that time. I think he's also, like, he was on television a lot, this guy. Like, he was even in Murder, She Wrote.
Now you're speaking my language.
I knew I'd get that reaction. So that's it for Zero G. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R's Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.